The Buddha realized, at least intellectually, I would say, to come to that full realization is another story, a story we're all working on. And if I get that clear, then I have a sense for the goal. And if I have a sense of the goal, then everything else that I do, sila, samadhi, panya, should fit in. Right? If I don't have a sense of what I think the Buddha might have realized, and I just do practices which don't have that aim in mind and aren't informed by that aim, I can do things which are pleasing, but they'd be kind of hit and miss, and they're not understood fully. And then my practice is kind of, very much hit and miss. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. So when you think about, like, some people will say to me, "Oh, I don't want to get enlightened. I just want to be, a bit happier." I don't think that's a good idea. I mean, I think it's a good idea being happier. But I think just to not try to pick up at least what might have the Buddha realized, not to have some sense of that, then I don't think one can understand why he taught what he taught. And he taught what he taught because of his enlightenment, right? He didn't teach an abstract philosophical theory. He taught because he had realized something. He has that realization, and then he figures out, okay, how can I share that with other people? How can I share the path with other people? So when one thinks about Nibbana or enlightenment or whatever, there's that whole range of language we have, right? The uncreated, the unoriginated, the unformed, the deathless, limitless, timeless, cessation of greed, hatred, and delusion. So it has both a kind of negative way where things fall away, desire falls away, but it also has a more affirmative. But the affirmative is you can't pin it down, unconditioned, uncreated, unoriginated, deathless, timeless. These are not words that, you can't compute them, really. They're not made for computation. But when you read about someone like Ajahn Chah or Lopal Leong or the Buddha himself, you realize they've realized some kind of a peace which is not dependent. Either peace is not dependent on circumstance, on health, on people liking them or disliking them. It's independent in that sense, right? I really recommend you read the book by Ajahn Leong, No Worries. In that book, he talks about his own. I've been recommending everyone in Canada. Canada. I can know everyone in Canada. At Tissera, recommending they read this, and it's very very inspiring because he. Oh, this is 1972. Mm. You read about, he's really, as a young monk, he's just really working hard in the monastery. He goes back to his kuti and just practicing real hard. And then he describes the kind of where his mind went those last few days, and then his mind becomes peaceful. And then it was peaceful like that the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And it's been like that ever since. And then you realize, he's done it. Yeah, I love to read that, because you realize it's possible. But then, and then you kind of get a sense his mind's really shifted, because he says in that, if you remember that, he says, "I don't understand dukkha. I read about it. I know the words. I don't understand dukkha." And not that he's stupid. So he's realized something very profound, and it's unshakable. He's a busy monk. He's an abbot of our biggest monastery. A lot of people criticized him when he ran the monastery when Ajahn Chah was sick. He got a lot of flack. His mind doesn't move. It's always peaceful. So whatever Nibbana is, or whatever is possible, you have these kind of human recollections now, or Ajahn Chah, of a peace which is not dependent. Okay? And to me, that's very important, because then you can look at, well, what would be the method to realize that peace? That's the goal. What would be the method? And then you start to get into, okay, so what's the Buddha pointing to? He says that the five khandhas, the mind-body experience, is dependently originated. All our thoughts and our bodily feelings and our emotions and our personal histories and our gender and our aging process and our emotions are all dependently originated, depend. So we have the phrase, this being that comes to be, right? With the arising of that arises, this not being that does not come to be, with the cessation of this that ceases. So what doesn't arise and what doesn't cease? Right? And it can't be the khandhas. So then you begin to see the method of letting, why we talk about letting go, but letting go of what? Letting go of attachment, a very, very important word, attachment to the khandhas. So that you have to figure out. You have to figure out for yourself, what did the Buddha mean by the khandhas? What does he mean by attachment? What does he mean by letting go? Because as long as my attention is on that which is dependently originated, which depends, I can never realize the end of it. All right? And so craving, the issue of craving comes up. Craving is very sticky. And craving in Pali Buddhism is always associated with ignorance. So we have good kinds of desire, the aspiration for nibbana, but craving or tanha is always associated with ignorance, not understanding. And so you see how sticky the five khandhas are. Thoughts, emotions, memories, fear, resentment, you know, all the stuff that we get stuck on. You say, okay, that's the practice. And it makes and it's different than just trying to be a nice person. It's not like a get better philosophy, because it has a more profound goal. So the reason for not being angry is not just because anger is such a drag, but because anger is sticky, right? It keeps you stuck on the five khandhas. And then you begin to see the logic of compassion. You see the logic of metta. Not, you know, metta is kind of taught very much as like prayer now in Buddhism. Yeah, I don't think it was designed for that. You know, so I think of Ajahn Jayanto, maybe, well, I'm sitting in Canada, may you have great committees, may the bucks flow in, you know, may you be happy, may you send these metta vibes to him. But that's not what metta is. I will do it, I promise. But that's not what metta is about. You know, if you think about it in terms of khandhas, metta is about non-attachment to aversion, all the manner of aversion we have, be it self-hatred, be it hatred of others, be it resentment, be it, you know, all of that side of our mind which is very sticky with aversion. So then you begin to see, like, self-aversion. Why? That's just not a good idea. You know, and a lot of us suffer from that because we have very highly developed critical faculties. We're very good at that. We're good at finding fault. But finding fault with oneself, just doing the opposite self, oh, you're wonderful. It's just another sticky bit, right? But just seeing the very tendency to be self-critical is sticky. You know, I'm still wrapped up with the khandhas. Or do the other, that I'm a wonderful person, I'm, you know, the most fabulous creation since Newton or something like that. That's also just a stupid, because it's still sticky. So you begin to see the logic of non-attachment to the khandhas and the logic of compassion and love. Not love, which is smarmy and attached, but the Brahma Viharas. And then you see, oh, that's the method. That compassion is the method, that mudita is the method, that kindness is the method, that upekkha is the method. Not an end in itself, not a goal. Because when you open the heart and you do practices of... And it's like doing mudita practice. And look at a beautiful piece of art, or a person's success, or a child's beautiful creation, and they make something, and they're very, very happy. Notice how that the openness of mudita, appreciation and joy of others, is not sticky. You know, you don't get stuck with it. You just go, oh, great, you're doing well, and you walk away from it free. Whereas greed and aversion, you don't walk away from it free. You're carrying around the mind all the time. So the logic of the Brahma Viharas, rather than it just being like, oh, I should be a kinder person, or I should do metta more, which just becomes a kind of good intention, but based on usually self-criticism. you know, I should be a kinder person rather than kindness is a practice. That's different. It's not like an intellectual position. The stickiness of covetousness and greed. You see how if I keep thinking about things that I want for the monastery or things that I want for myself or distractions that I'm looking for, etc., that's very sticky. I'm stuck in the khandhas. Then I see the logic of renunciation. Not because it's bad to have beautiful things, not because it's evil to have beautiful things, but if I'm always thinking of beautiful things and ownership and so on, it's sticky. It keeps my mind, it keeps my attention in the wrong place. Fear, worry, the kind of whole anxious side of my life, needing just a faith, you know, faith in my capacity to be aware, to be present. So once I begin to see, where is my mind sticky? For me, my own attachments are very much caught up with fear. I'm a very fearful person, very, very shy, a lot of depression. As in my early years of monasticism, you wouldn't have wanted to know me. I was not this kind of jolly lone paw, I tell you. I was a really heavy dude, as they say. And I could clear rooms with my negativity. And it was, you know, awful, and I didn't like it, but there it was. You know? And so then I go into self-hatred, and it's terrible. But no, but it's not that it's terrible, it's just attachment. That's the problem. It's not that it's bad to be depressed, I mean, it's awful to be depressed, actually. But it's attachment that's the problem. So then I say, okay, so how do I get out of this? What's the method? Service, generosity, samadhi, more metta, more heart, all these kinds of things, right? And because it's logical, it makes sense. So Buddhism always leads with right view, right understanding, rather than should-bes. It doesn't lead with should-bes. It leads with right understanding. And come on in, Sean. Go on up. Don't worry about us. Huh? Yeah. So if you begin to see the sila, obviously sila, that's got to be the method. And you begin to see, yeah, that's the Buddha's teaching is very logical that way. And then what happens when we begin to do that? When we begin to practice the Brahmaviharas and slowly let go of the fears and desires and so on. What happens is your mind becomes available. Your attention is no longer addicted to the khandhas. It's no longer magnetized. It's no longer sticky with the khandhas. It's available. And this is a word I found from an Advaita Vedanta teacher, Jean Klein. He would say, what you have to sustain is watchfulness and availability. And availability is an interesting word. Availability is like you're not grasping anything. You're not taking a position. If I take an intellectual position about what I have to do to become enlightened or anything, any kind of concept like that, I'm not available. I'm stuck in a memory. So to be available and watchful means you keep letting go of everything and you're totally present without any concepts, no structures to the way things are. Very hard to do. But we have a whole build-up of concepts and structures. We've read so much, jhanas and sotapatti and anagami and nibbana, and then, you know, we have this whole structure which then we put upon, is this it? Have I got it now? Am I close? And all that structure makes you unavailable. So letting go becomes more and more profound conceptually in the heart in terms of being open. And then we can't do anything. In fact, the very trying to do something becomes the more subtle part of the practice, doesn't it? You begin to see the very sense of a doer. You begin to intuit even that, the doer becomes more and more subtle. And that kind of availability and watchfulness then takes you to emptiness. That's what we mean by emptiness, where the sense of a self is not operating, ego is not operating. But you can't do that willfully. You can set up the conditions, but you can't do that willfully because it's letting go. So then you begin to you see how the foundation is, like compassion, stillness, steadiness, and then what I use a lot is this body awareness for that. You can And when you're practicing and you're very much making a lot of effort, the very sense of me doing something. But if you can make conscious your body, it's a good way to think about it. Like make conscious your arm, make conscious your hand. What do you have to do? Like if I want to be aware of what my hand is before I conceptualize it, before I define it, what do I have to do? I have to stop and I have to listen. I have to be receptive. I have to wait. And if I do this now, if I wait, then that's a tingle, right? It's always tingling. It's always there. But I don't have the patience to notice it until it hurts. Or I want some pleasure from it or something. So now I'm deliberately just waiting. Just let this become conscious. And all of a sudden the body becomes conscious. And the body becomes feeling and energy around this kind of lump of me sitting in the body looking through my head. And as you do that, as you get a sense of like a whole body awareness, you begin to see that awareness is not in your head, it's not in your eyeballs, that the body's in awareness. The body's in awareness. That thoughts are in awareness. All perceptions are in awareness. And you begin to, I begin at least, that's what I do, is I begin to play around with perceptions. You know, like when the people were talking next door, I used that perception. I said, this noise, and the ambulance went by, I said, this noise is in awareness. Now it's just a perception, but it's interesting what happens, because usually there's me here, and then there's the noise through the wall, right? And a sense of self is created, and maybe a judgment, or a thought, well, I wonder what they're talking about, or what kind of music are they listening to? So there's a self and another, or the ambulance, or... But then, if you change your perception to the very sense of self listening to sound, the very sense of I is in awareness. Happening in awareness. And you begin to get a sense that awareness is limitless. It's not bounded. And you begin to see why awareness is the portal or the entry to the unconditioned. You begin to understand that intuitively, not through bookish definitions, but you can just feel that, yeah, that awareness has no boundaries. And you begin to abide as that awareness, boundaryless, limitless, unconditioned, because all conditions come and go within that. And one begins to use those kinds of perceptions. When we were in London in 1977, or was it 79? Lajan Cha was there, and we had a shrine room about this size, narrower, you know, and had this, it was on a very busy street called Haverstock Hill. And the window, it was an Edwardian building, and the windows were 11 foot tall. It was about 12 foot ceilings, massive windows, which weren't doubly insulated or anything. And among other things, as well as the cold, the noise came in. So it was the noisiest place I've ever meditated in, because there was a lot of heavy traffic, and there was a pub across the road. And there was the noise of the pub, and on the second story of the pub, there was a rock band used to practice. So everyone that came to this vihara, they all lived in quieter places. We had the noisiest place in town. And Ajahn Chah said, he's so brilliant. He's just brilliant. He said, stop going out there and bothering that noise. And it was, you know, it's very true. You know, the noise is just there. And then there's me going out there and bothering it. And it was such a good lesson. So then if you see that, you see how that sense of self, that the sense of me here and the sound out there is actually one piece. That sound triggers a sense of a self. It's dependently originated. It depends. But if I begin to say, no, that sense of self arises in awareness. My identity is no longer with the sense of self or the ego, but rather with awareness. And that you begin to see that has no structure, there's no concepts around it, it has limitless. And you begin to sense what we mean by emptiness. I begin to see that's important. That's very, very important to begin to realize and to sense. And then the deepening of that practice becomes one where the sense of silence, the silence you begin to see is not the silence of circumstance. Like we went to the museum today, and we went into the Japanese collection, and they have one room which is very dark. beautiful Japanese architecture, a massive Buddhas, one of which didn't have the lights on, so he got his flashlight out and looked at it. But just a sense of going in a deep silence of space. That's not your mind, that's the room, but the room points to your mind. So I call that circumstantial silence. It's helpful. Forest monastery is very helpful because it creates the circumstances where you notice silence more. But if the silence that I like is just a circumstance, then I leave the room and I feel annoyed, then I haven't understood the deeper silence. Right? So what is the silence that is not a matter of circumstance? It's through awareness you realize that. So then there is the sound of the ambulance and people next door, and there's the pain in the knee, or there's the memory, and it's happening in awareness. And so there are our perceptual... You can play around with perceptions, can't you? You can create, like I can say the glass is half full, half empty. Right? It affects me that way. So introducing that kind of a perception is happening in awareness. It always takes you out. Not in some kind of disassociated neurosis, you know, but actually you're not grasping anymore. It's non-grasping. That was happened in awareness. The lights happen in awareness. And that's what non-grasping is about. It's not being void of any kind of human emotion or human feeling or memory or thought, or it's not that. It's just seeing these are just the kundas coming and going, and they are not reliable, they're sticky, don't go there, they're dangerous, they're unsatisfactory, all that kind of language we use. They're not bad, they're not evil, they're just not nibbana. It's just not where it's at. You know, it's a red herring. The five kundas are a red herring, really. It's just not the place to look. So that, and I think that's very important, because sometimes we bring in Christian ideas of evil and bad around the kundas, or around greed or whatever, but it's not evil or bad, it's just you're looking in the wrong place. That's all. So if you understand the logic of it, and you understand that the Buddha is pointing to something unconditioned, uncreated, unoriginated, unformed, and then anything which is conditioned or has a sign or has a quality or has limits or boundaries, it can't be it. That can't be it. That can't be it. That can't be it. And that letting go is to say, well, what could it be? It can only be awareness. It could only be the hope. And then abiding in awareness, and then you have to wait, but wait for nothing. You have to be watchful and available for long periods of time. And I think that's what these monks like Ajahn Liam and all of us are trying to do. No, I don't think it's so much like holding on to an object with some kind of samadhi practice. I think it's much grander than that. It's just being watchful and available for long periods of time. And that's difficult. That's very difficult. So when one reads about Lompo Liam in that, in his biography, autobiography in No Worries, it's amazing. Kind of. And then I'd been walking all day and my feet were a bit sore. You know, he's not walking outside, he's walking back and forth. And my feet got a bit sore, so I thought I'd sit down. And then he sits for 8 hours and doesn't move. The determination of this man. But he's not talking about extreme states of absorption or anything. He said, I just practice for the sake of practice. And his mind and Lompo Cha too, it's like peace beckons to him and almost grabs his mind. I can try to describe it that way. So that sounds maybe impossible to do so much walking and so on. But I think to be watchful and available, we can do that. We might not have deep states of samadhi, but we can do that. I can be watchful and available. I just have to remember to do it, that's all. So it's very human that way. Very, 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 it's very accessible. And then to trust in that. So what happens then is all kinds of materials start to come up, like self-doubt. When self-doubt comes up. If you just know, that's just in awareness. You don't have to then be confident. You can have self-doubt and not have to go to the opposite of being confident. Because if you go to the opposite, then you're back into self-doubt again. But if you have self-doubt, you say, wow, I don't know what I'm doing. And that's in awareness. You're free. You're free of the need for constantly getting its opposite. But we get so tricked. We get so tricked by these, you know, there's some aspects of our sense of self are so believable, doubts and self-doubt and worries and those kinds of things, and always go back, oh, if I'm stuck to it, I'm not watchful or available. That's all. It's not wrong, it's not bad, it's I'm not available, so be quiet. It's just, don't have a clue. Or you have some grudge against someone, you feel bad about it, or you can't forgive someone. Fine, okay, this is a feeling of not being able to forgive. And because that, we get stuck that way too. We want to be very, very liberal-minded, good-hearted people who always forgive and da-da-da-da. But, you know, someone you really think is a total creep, right? And then you feel guilty for thinking the person is total... Maybe they are a total creep. But you just feel that, oh, this, you know, this person is really awful. And then, oh, this is a perception that's happening in awareness. So you don't have to be a kind of goody-good Buddhist who's kind of really... like a sticky bun. You know, it's always very nice. You're a real human being with real emotions, but it's just the khandhas. And that's just such a relief. Because if you always have to be good, well, we're finished. on a moral basis, yeah. You know, we practice right speech, we practice, and we all do that. We all know that. But at that inner level, as Ajahn Sumedho says, it all belongs. You know, the good, bad, and the ugly. It all belongs. And then, where does it belong? It belongs in awareness. And so I think, you know, that like thinking through the teaching in that way, really getting a sense of what did the Buddha realize? What did these teachers realize? Then you get a sense of method. And then it all falls into place. Depends on the origination, through characteristics, the precepts, development of the heart, through the Brahma Viharas and so on. It's a really beautiful package. And it's a brilliant, brilliant package. But you don't have to do it all. All you just need enough is to let go. And some people need a lot. Some people, but all you have to do is let go. So sometimes we think, well, if I study more. You know, some people keep studying. What are you studying? I meet people who like studying the five khandhas, you know. I really have to understand the five khandhas. And they just get, you know, kind of all gluey in their brains. Just mind body, that's all it is. So then we can, you know, people can feel kind of like, certainly I had that feeling, if I have studied more, then I'll know more. But that's just information. How much information do you need? My dad used to say, the more you read, the more you'll know. So I used to read these difficult German philosophers and I would feel more stupid because I couldn't understand them. But that's just attachment to intellect. And then the beauty, the liberation from intellect, it's not being stupid, it's just knowing that sometimes you have dumb thoughts. And sometimes you have brilliant thoughts. Less and less now as we get older. But it's so lovely to be free from, like as a teacher, it's delightful to not have to be an expert. You know, it's really such a freedom to say, I don't know. And people say, well, what about rebirth? It beats me. I really don't know. I had one woman, she sends me an email. She's got all the... She sends me an email with, I've got aphids on my roses, right? And what am I going to do? Demand, like, it's my fault. The five precepts are my fault. So I wrote back and said, it's your problem, it's your roses. Anyways. So, I think that's sufficient of being silly now. So I think that's... Some thoughts on letting go. Non-attachment. There you go.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Save me before I get more silly. It's been a long day.